A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and I'll admit, I had to sit with it for a minute. He said our episode dissecting Trump's rhetorical strategies was, quote, disturbingly good. Disturbing because neither of us endorses the politics. But the graft was undeniable. His question is, can we take those same rhetorical instruments and channel them into the two most everyday persuasion scenarios most people face, a job interview and a client sales pitch? And for the pitch, he wants us to imagine an architecture firm trying to land a contract with a developer. So we're not asking whether these techniques work. We're asking how to use them ethically, in situations where the stakes are your career or your firm's next big project.
This is exactly the kind of question that makes Daniel's prompts worth doing a whole podcast around, because most people walk into an interview and default to listing qualifications. Most architecture firms walk into a pitch and default to showing their portfolio. Trump's toolkit offers something completely counterintuitive. It triggers emotional buy-in before the logical case even lands, and the research backs this up. Linguistic analyses of his major speeches show the trinary structure. Three items, with the third as the emotional punch, appears in 78% of his major addresses. That's not improvisation, that's a pattern.
Let's get the framework straight before we start building the playbook. What exactly are we borrowing, and where do we draw the line?
The first is the trinary structure. Three items, third one, lands the emotional payload. The classic example, we're going to bring back jobs, bring back manufacturing, and bring back our dignity. Jobs and manufacturing are concrete. Dignity is the thing you feel. The second is conversational framing. Phrases like, you know what I'm talking about, that create shared identity before it's earned. They reduce perceived distance between speaker and listener by activating mirror neurons. The third is repetition with variation, anaphora, technically, where you repeat a core message in different contexts, each time with a slightly different angle. Controlled studies show this increases recall by up to 40%.
The ethical boundary, because I know someone listening is already uncomfortable. We're not endorsing the man. We're extracting the craft. These are tools of rhetoric, not ideology. The same hammer builds a house or breaks a window.
And the research confirms these devices work because they align with how the brain processes patterns and emotional cues, not because of any political affiliation. The trinary structure, for example, exploits something called the serial position effect. People remember the first and last items in a list best. By putting the emotional payload third, you're placing it in the most recallable position while also giving the listener a sense of completion. Three feels complete, two feels unfinished, four feels like a list, three is a story.
Three is a story. I'm going to steal that. Let's go deep on the first mechanism, because this is the one most people get wrong.
Most people think the trinary is just listing three things. It's not. The structure is concrete item, emotional payload. The first two establish credibility. The third is what makes the listener lean forward. In a job interview, the default answer to tell me about yourself is chronological autobiography. I studied X, then worked at Y, then moved to Z. It's a resume recital. The trinary version is, I started in operations, moved into strategy, and now I specialize in turning underperforming teams into top quartile performers. That third item isn't a job title, it's a promise. It's the thing the interviewer will remember when you walk out of the room.
It works because you've earned the right to make the promise. The first two items are factual. They're verifiable. By the time you hit the third, the listener's brain has already nodded twice. The third one feels true because the first two were true.
This is what linguists call the credibility ladder. Each true statement makes the next one feel more credible, even if it's aspirational. Trump does this constantly. Two verifiable facts, then a sweeping claim that feels earned. In an interview, you're not making a sweeping claim. You're making a specific evidence-backed promise about what you'll deliver, but the mechanism is identical.
the architectured pitch version of this. And I want to stay on this because Daniel specifically asked about it. The default pitch opens with credentials. We've been in business 40 years. We've designed 200 buildings. We've won these awards. What's the Trinary version?
We design buildings that are sustainable, cost-effective, and beautiful. Sustainable is the concrete spec. Cost-effective is the business case. Beautiful is what the developer's buyers will feel when they walk into the lobby. That third item closes the deal because it's not about the architecture. It's about the developer's customer. You shifted the frame from, look what we can do, to look what your buyers will experience.
The developer has sat through 12 pitches that all said, we're experienced, we're award-winning, we're reliable. Nobody remembers the 12th firm that said they're reliable. Everyone remembers the firm that made them imagine a buyer walking into a beautiful lobby.
There's a neurological reason for this. The brain processes concrete nouns and emotional concepts in different regions. Sustainable and cost-effective activate the prefrontal cortex, analytical evaluation. Beautiful activates the limbic system, emotional response. The trinary structure forces the listener's brain to toggle from analysis to emotion in the space of a single sentence. That toggle is what makes the message stick.
The structure isn't just rhetorical. It's neurological. You're literally changing which part of the brain is listening mid-sentence.
That's why it feels different than a normal pitch. A normal pitch keeps the listener in evaluation mode the whole time. The trinary structure ends in feeling mode. And decisions, especially hiring decisions and contract awards, are made in feeling mode and justified with logic afterward. The neuroscience on this is robust. Antonio Damasio's work on somatic markers showed that people with damage to the emotional centers of the brain become incapable of making decisions, even though their analytical faculties are intact. You need emotion to decide. The trinary structure delivers it.
All right, mechanism 2. This is the one that makes me the most uncomfortable because it feels like the line between persuasion and manipulation gets thin here.
And that's exactly why we need to understand it. Conversational framing is when you use phrases that assume shared experience before it's established. You know what I'm talking about. You've seen this before. We all know what happens next. Trump uses these constantly. They create intimacy. They reduce the perceived distance between speaker and listener. And they work by activating mirror neurons, the same neural mechanism that makes you wince when you see someone stub their toe.
When someone says you've seen this before, your brain doesn't stop to verify whether you actually have. It just accepts the premise and starts searching for a matching memory. You're being pulled into agreement before you've had a chance to evaluate.
And in a job interview, the ethical version of this is to frame a shared problem. You've probably seen this before. Candidates who can talk about their resume but can't talk about their impact. Now you've done something subtle but powerful. You've positioned yourself as the person who understands the interviewer's frustration. You're not a candidate being evaluated. You're a colleague commiserating about bad candidates. The frame has shifted.
That's the power dynamic flip. The interview starts as judge me. With one sentence, it becomes, we're solving a problem together. And the interviewer's brain shifts from evaluation mode to problem-solving mode.
Here's the architecture pitch version. The developer has been burned before. Every developer has. The conversational framing move is, you've seen this problem. The delays, the cost overruns, the miscommunication between the design team and the contractors. We've solved it. You're not selling. You're agreeing with their pain. You've positioned yourself as the person who gets it.
The key word there is we've. Not you have a problem and I have a solution. It's we both seen this mess and we figured out how to avoid it. The shared identity is built into the pronoun.
The research on this is striking. Studies on persuasive messaging show that when a speaker uses inclusive pronouns, we, us, our, the listener's brain shows increased activity in regions associated with self-referential processing. In other words, the listener's brain starts treating the speaker's goals as their own goals. That's not manipulation. That's alignment. The ethical distinction is whether you're aligning around a genuine shared interest or fabricating one.
The test is the shared experience real? If you're an architect and you genuinely understand the developer's pain around cost overruns, framing it conversationally is just good communication. If you're pretending to understand a pain you've never dealt with, that's where it tips into something else.
And that's the through line for all three mechanisms. They work because they feel authentic. If you over-engineer them, they backfire. Trump's delivery appears spontaneous because he's internalized the pattern. You need to do the same. You can't be in the interview mentally counting 1, 2, 3. You have to internalize the structure so it comes out naturally.
Which brings us to mechanism. 3. Repetition with variation. This is the one that sounds the most obvious and is actually the hardest to do well.
Because most people hear repetition and think say the same thing over and over, that's not what this is. Trump doesn't just repeat build the wall. He says it in a rally, in an interview, in a debate, each time with a different angle, a different context, a different emotional register. The core message stays the same. The framing changes. Your brain remembers the pattern, not the exact words. And controlled studies show this increases recall by up to 40%.
In an interview, you don't literally repeat, "I turn chaos into order," 3 times. You say it once as a headline. Then you tell a story about a project that was falling apart and how you restructured it. Then later, when they ask about your weaknesses, you say, "Sometimes I move too fast to impose structure, because I can't stand watching chaos when I know there's a better way." Same message, completely different context. The interviewer doesn't consciously register the repetition, but their brain does.
That's the art of it. The repetition has to be invisible to the conscious mind, but legible to the pattern recognition systems. It's like a bass line in a song. You don't notice it's there until someone points it out, but if it weren't there, the song wouldn't hold together.
The architecture pitch version of this, and I think this is where it gets really practical, is what Trump's speechwriters call looping back. Every question, every slide, every answer loops back to one of your core messages. The developer asks about materials. You answer with materials, then loop back. And that choice of materials is exactly why our projects stay on budget, which is what I mentioned about our cost guarantee. The developer asks about timeline. You answer, then loop. And the timeline is driven by our early stage risk assessment, same process that lets us guarantee the budget.
Every answer becomes a reminder of your core promise. And by the end of the pitch, the developer has heard your core messages 6 or 7 times without ever feeling like you repeated yourself. Their brain has built a neural pathway that connects this firm to budget certainty. That pathway is what fires when they're making the decision.
Now that we've got the mechanisms, let's look at the knock-on effect. What actually happens when you use these in the wild?
The biggest shift is in power dynamics. In a normal interview, the power sits entirely with the interviewer. The conversational framing move, you've probably seen this before, subtly redistributes that power. You're no longer a supplicant. You're a peer who understands their world well enough to name its frustrations. That shift is almost invisible in the moment, but it changes everything about how the interviewer processes what you say.
The architecture pitch has the same dynamic. The default posture of a firm pitching a developer is, "Please pick us." The conversational framing posture is, "We understand your problems better than anyone, and here's how we solve them. One is asking for approval. The other is offering a solution." The developer feels the difference even if they can't name it.
There's another knock-on effect I want to flag. These techniques force you to prepare differently. Most people prepare for an interview by memorizing answers to expected questions. Most firms prepare for a pitch by building a slide deck that walks through their portfolio. The Trump-style approach forces you to prepare by identifying your core messages first, then building everything else around them. It's a completely different preparation workflow.
That's actually a better way to put it. It's not just a communication technique, it's a preparation discipline. You don't start with, "What will they ask me?" You start with, "What 3 things do I want them to remember when I walk out?" Then you build every answer, every story, every example to reinforce one of those 3 things.
There's research supporting this. Studies on the mere exposure effect show that repeated exposure to a message increases liking and trust, even when the repetition isn't consciously registered. But the effect only works when the repetition feels natural, not forced. So the preparation discipline is, internalize the core messages so deeply that they come out in different words every time without you having to think about it.
Let's talk about 2 specific moves that deserve their own spotlight. The first is what I'll call the negative contrast. Trump does this constantly. Look at what they did. Now look at what we'll do. He paints a picture of a failed status quo, then positions himself as the alternative. In a pitch, this is devastatingly effective if you do it right.
The architecture version, most firms hand you a design and then fight over change orders for the next 18 months. We hand you a design and a guarantee. If it doesn't hit your budget, we eat the overage. You haven't named a competitor. You haven't said anything negative about anyone specific, but you've drawn a line between most firms and we, and that line is a guarantee. The developer now has a concrete reason to choose you that has nothing to do with your portfolio.
The contrast makes the guarantee memorable in a way that just stating the guarantee wouldn't be. If you walk in and say, we offer a budget guarantee, that's a feature. If you say most firms fight over change orders, we guarantee the budget, that's a story. The contrast creates the narrative tension that makes the resolution satisfying.
The job interview version, most candidates will tell you about their responsibilities. I'd rather tell you about the quarter where I inherited a team that was missing every deadline and turned them into the top performing unit in the division. You haven't insulted anyone. You've just drawn a contrast between a generic approach and your specific approach. The interviewer now has a framework for remembering you. You're the one who talks about impact, not responsibilities.
The second move is the future narrative. Trump paints a vivid picture of a future state. We're going to have so much winning, you're going to get tired of winning. It's not a promise about policy, it's a promise about how you'll feel. In an interview, the future narrative move is, in 6 months, I want to be the person your team comes to when a project is off the rails. Not because I have the title, but because they know I'll get it back on track.
That's so much more powerful than, I'm a good problem solver. You're not describing your past, you're selling a future they want to buy into. And neurologically, this triggers the dopamine response, anticipation of reward. The interviewer's brain starts to associate you with a positive future state. That association is what tips close decisions.
The architecture version. 18 months from now, when the first buyers walk into the lobby, they're going to stop and look up. They won't know why the space feels right. They won't know it's because the ceiling height draws the eye to the natural light. They'll just know they want to live here. That's the building we design. You've made the developer imagine their buyers experiencing the building. You've made them feel the outcome.
This is where the ethical boundary comes back into focus. The future narrative only works if you can actually deliver it. If you promise a feeling you can't create, you've just made a fraudulent sale. But if you believe you can deliver that experience, and you have the track record to back it up, then the future narrative is just making the outcome tangible for the client. It's the difference between saying, we're good architects, and saying, here's what your buyers will feel. One is a claim about you, the other is a promise about their customer.
Let's address the elephant in the room. Some people listening are thinking, this feels manipulative. Isn't all of this just emotional manipulation dressed up in a suit?
I think about it this way. All communication is persuasion. Every word you choose in an interview is chosen to create an impression. The question isn't whether you're persuading. The question is whether you're doing it intentionally or accidentally. Most people persuade accidentally. They default to whatever feels natural, which is usually listing facts and hoping the listener connects the dots. The techniques we're describing are just intentional persuasion. And intentional persuasion, paired with genuine substance, is more honest than accidental persuasion, because you're taking responsibility for the impression you're creating.
The research confirms that authenticity is the multiplier. Without it, these techniques fall flat. Trump's rhetoric works because he believes what he's saying. If you don't believe your own pitch, no trinary structure in the world will save you. The techniques amplify what's already there. They don't create conviction out of nothing.
There's a practical reason for this. When you're trying to remember a scripted trinary structure, your cognitive load goes up, your delivery gets stiff, your eye contact drops. The interviewer's brain registers this person is performing, rather than this person is communicating. But when you've internalized the structure, when it's just how you talk about your work, your delivery is natural. Your authenticity signals are intact. The structure works because it's invisible.
What do you actually do on Monday morning? Let's get concrete.
First move. Before your next interview or pitch, write down your core message in 3 words, not 3 sentences. For an interview, it might be reliable, fast, accurate. For an architecture pitch, it might be budget, timeline, marketability. Then build a trinary structure around each word. The third item in each trinary is your emotional hook. Make it count.
The three words aren't just a slogan. They're the skeleton that every answer hangs on. If your three words are reliable, fast, accurate, and the interviewer asks about a conflict with a coworker, your answer loops back to one of those three. The conflict happened because I was pushing for accuracy on a deliverable, and my colleague wanted to ship faster. Here's how we resolved it. You've answered the question and reinforced your core message in the same breath.
Second move, practice the loopback technique. This is the one that feels awkward at first and becomes natural with repetition. Every time you're asked a question, answer it directly, then loop back to your core message. That's a great question about timeline, and it's exactly why our approach focuses on early stage risk mitigation, which connects to the cost guarantee I mentioned earlier. The loopback has to feel organic, not mechanical. If it sounds like you're ignoring the question to repeat a talking point, you've lost.
The test is, does the loopback add value to the answer, or does it replace the answer? If the developer asks about materials and you say, great question, and that's why we guarantee the budget, without actually addressing materials, you sound evasive. The loopback has to be an extension of the answer, not a substitute for it.
Third move, record yourself using these techniques. Listen for authenticity. If it sounds like you're reading a script, you're overdoing it. The goal is to sound like the best version of yourself, not a caricature. Trump's delivery works because he's internalized the pattern. You need to do the same. The recording doesn't lie. You'll hear the stiffness immediately.
I'd add a fourth move that nobody talks about. Before the interviewer pitch, spend 5 minutes visualizing the conversation, not rehearsing lines, visualizing the dynamic. Picture yourself using conversational framing and feeling relaxed, doing it. Picture the interviewer or developer nodding along. The visualization isn't woo-woo. It's priming your brain to feel familiar with the situation, which reduces the cognitive load when you're actually in it. Lower cognitive load means more natural delivery.
That's actually backed by sports psychology research. Athletes who visualize their performance show measurable improvements in execution. The same mechanism applies to high-stakes communication. Your brain doesn't fully distinguish between a vividly imagined experience and a real one. If you've already experienced the conversation succeeding, your anxiety drops and your authenticity signals improve.
Let's talk about a real case study, because I think this makes it tangible. There was a candidate who interviewed at Google and used the future narrative move. Instead of saying, I've experience with cloud cost optimization, they said, I want to be the person who reduces your cloud costs by 30% in the first quarter. They got the offer. The interviewer later told them the specific number was what stuck. Not cloud cost optimization. 30% in the first quarter. The future narrative made the value tangible and memorable.
The architecture version. There's a well-known case of a firm that used the negative contrast move against a competitor with a reputation for cost overruns. They didn't name the competitor. They just said, we're the only firm in this room that will give you a written budget guarantee. They won a $50 million contract. The developer said afterward, you were the only firm that talked about risk up front. The contrast made the guarantee stand out because nobody else was offering one.
What I love about both examples is that the technique wasn't hiding a weakness. It was highlighting a genuine strength. The Google candidate actually could reduce cloud costs. The architecture firm actually did offer a budget guarantee. The rhetoric didn't create the value. It made the value impossible to ignore.
That's the core ethical test. Are you using these techniques to communicate genuine value more effectively, or are you using them to fabricate value that doesn't exist? The techniques are neutral. The intent isn't.
Let's wrap with the big question. Does the source of the technique matter?
I'd argue the technique is neutral, but the source creates an obligation. If you're borrowing rhetorical tools from a figure whose politics you reject, you have an obligation to use those tools ethically. To build, not to deceive. To communicate genuine value, not to fabricate it. The research confirms that authenticity is the multiplier. Without it, the techniques fall flat. But with it, they're just good communication.
There's a future dimension to this, too. As AI-generated speech becomes indistinguishable from human, the ability to use rhetorical structure authentically will become a differentiator. The machines can mimic the words. They can even mimic the trinary structure. They can't yet mimic the conviction. When you sit across from an interviewer and say, I turn underperforming teams into top quartile performers, and you mean it, and you've done it, and your voice carries the weight of having done it, no language model can replicate that. The technique is just the delivery system. The payload is you.
That's the thing I hope people take from this. The trinary structure, conversational framing, repetition with variation, these are tools. They're hammers. What matters is what you build with them. If you build a genuine case for why you're the right person for the job, or why your firm is the right partner for the project, you're not manipulating anyone. You're just communicating clearly. And clear communication about genuine value is the opposite of manipulation.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The term lava tube was first applied to volcanic caves by American geologist Harold Stearns in the 1920s, during a survey of the Hawaiian Islands, but the largest known lava tubes on Earth were later discovered in the Cape Verde Archipelago, where some passages stretch over 3 kilometers and host entire ecosystems of blind. Pigmentless arthropods found nowhere else on the planet.
3 kilometers of blind arthropods. Thanks, Hilbert. This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping the show running, and to Daniel for sending in the kind of question that makes us think harder than we planned to. If you want to send us your own weird prompt, email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com. We read everyone. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. Use the tools. Build something good.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from long ear. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.